Now I have quarter-inch superflex, but that has termination on each end of it. Either B and C terminations or has any kind of termination. So maybe I could probably use one of those cables with some sort of small something attached with maybe a barrel and a B and C to give me a very small type of probe using a reverse fish. That's a possibility. That's the best cable I have as far as shielding. The quarter-inch superflex is, I guess, just like hardline, probably gives you about 120 dB of isolation to inside out, but better than double shielding cable. I'll give it a try and see what happens. I'll get back to you next week. If I come up with anything concrete, I'll definitely bring it up.
Too bad you don't have a ratty piece of semi-rigid somewhere in the house where you could temporarily solder a piece of wire to the center conductor and bring it into a small loop, a quarter inch in diameter, back to the shield. And back to you, Joe.
You're saying without even using any kind of connector or adapter at the other end of the cable, just simply open up the cable, cut it open, and solder a loop between the center pins of the shield. That's what you're saying?
That's one way of doing it. But you don't even have to take the connector off one end. If it's a UT-141, 0.141 semiconductor diameter, in that case, the center conductor of the cable is the center conductor of the connector. You could temporarily solder a small piece of wire to the center conductor of the connector on one end and bring it around beyond the nut of the connector back to the outer shield of the semi-rigid. And I'm saying that's temporary because with careful cleaning, you could remove that loop of wire that you soldered on and you haven't destroyed the SMA connector at the end. But a piece of semi-rigid cable makes a beautiful sniffer. To be 2LYY, hit your IW. Thank you,
Jack.
Go ahead, Eric.
I do not have semi-rigid cable that long. I don't even really have anything like that. Anything I have like that's all within the instrument itself. I don't have spare stuff like that. I only have quarter-inch, what's called quarter-inch superflex for test cables. That's all I have available. I don't have a semi-rigid line at all.
You don't need a whole lot of length of semi-rigid. A couple of inches of it will do with the right adapter you connect it onto the end of your test cable. Eric wants to say something. KE2EJ, KE2RIW in the net.
KE2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, something I learned really odd after working on all this microwave junk that I got. I have a piece of semi-rigid cable, two SMA connectors on it, and I have an SMA turnaround or a barrel, and on the end of that little barrel, I have a little piece of wire that's soldered to the center pin, and another piece of wire that's soldered to the ground side. And the other side of the cable goes to the spectrum analyzer or the device that I'm using to sniff with. The semi-rigid cable is just a handle. I mean, you don't need semi-rigid cable, it just makes it convenient. K2RIW, K3J.
There's some ideas for you, Joe.
Okay, well, I don't have that available, so I can only use what I have, and I don't really want to solder something to the pins directly of the cable I'm using. Being that they've got, you know, good connectors on them, I don't really want to solder anything to the center pins. I'm upset with the way they are. If I can use something like an adapter and put another connector on the other side of that and bring that out with a small loop, I'll try doing that. I don't want to really wreck my cable that I have.
A piece of wire 268 and a little piece of wire between the shield and the center adapter.
I hear what you're saying, but if I have test cables that are pre-made that have BNCs on each end, or they have end mails on each end, I don't want to solder anything to the center pin of those connectors. Do you follow what I'm saying? I don't want to do that.
You got a BNC jack with a pair of pins on the end of it?
Yeah, this. What you may not have realized, Joe, is this reverse sniffer. It itself doesn't have to be a perfectly shielded structure. It is going to be a radiator. So if the adapters and junctions and everything else you've got to go from the source of the signal generator into this reverse sniffer, if they are leaky connectors, who cares? The signal coming out of the little piece of wire at the end, the loop, is going to be 50 dB stronger than the leakage of any one of your connectors. So how you build this thing is not critical. It's not being used in the receive mode. It's being used in the transmit mode. It's just a source of signal. But if the majority of the source of the signal is the loop at the end, the quarter-inch diameter loop, three-eighths of an inch diameter loop, and you can now hold it near individual connectors, individual cables, individual probes on a cavity that are without the cap on and so on, you can now take this very small source of signal, hold it in various places, and watch to see what the indication is. So this thing doesn't have to be elegant. It's a source of signal where the majority of the source is the loop of wire at the end. That's all that really counts. The B2RYY, K2RIW in the second hand.
I really understand what you're talking about. You want to make a very small loop at the end of a test cable, but what I'm telling you is I don't want to solder directly, something directly to the pins of the connectors on the test cable. That's something I don't want to do. I don't want to have something where I have to clean it off later on where it's not going to mate properly. I'll have to do what I have and find something, putting a barrel or something in series with the thing and coming out to maybe another spare BNC connector I have and making a small loop on the end of that. And I understand what you, as far as functionality, what you want to end up with, what you want me to end up with as far as the test cable. I do understand that, so I'll give it a try. Maybe by next week I'll have it deconstructed. I'll be able to do some poking around and see if I come up with something concrete. Thanks for the info. WHO
worldwide.
Here's a BNC
bell. You know, lose a BNC bell, won't kill you.
He could take a female BNC chassis mount connector, build the loop of wire on that female chassis mount connector, plug it into the end of his BNC to BNC cable. Over to you, Joe. K2RIW.
I understand what you're saying. If I have a chassis mount connector laying around that I'm not using, I can construct something on that. If I don't, I'll have to find another BNC cable that I can make and put a small loop on the end of that, and I'll use a female barrel on the end of my test cable, one of them, to be able to accomplish what you'd like me to accomplish. I do understand the theory of what you're talking about.
Good luck with that project, Joe. And we'll be hearing about it next week. And with that reverse sniffer, I give you a 90% chance you're going to find out where the leakage is coming from. Because now you can hold it near every connection in the receiver, the duplexing filter, and so on. Okay, the next person on our list was Ben, Kilo Delta 2, November, Oscar Uniform. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz, Ben. KD2NOU, K2RIW in the TechNet. One more call. Kilo Delta 2, November, Oscar Uniform. Are you there, Ben? K2RIW.
KD2NOU. Yes.
We've been calling you, Ben. Go right ahead with your question.
Sorry about that. So basically, I have two VHF, UHF radios. And I have a J-pole and a MagnaMan antenna. And the antennas, they're within like 3 feet of each other. Is that bad? And like, how could one blow up the other one, like while I'm transmitting?
I think the answer is no. With 3 feet of separation between two antennas, you are going to get a pretty strong amount of signal when you transmit in one and receive out of the other. Modern day receivers, though, particularly a handy talkie, you'd be amazed how rugged they are on the front end. I'll admit that 3 feet is pushing it a little bit. If you brought it down to 1 foot, I think you could get some damage. At 3 feet, I think you're pretty safe. 3 feet of separation between the two antennas, you've got the old 20 dB of separation, 20 dB of isolation, in that order. So, I don't think it's a problem. You have been operating this way for a while. Over to you, Ben. KD2NOU, K2LIW.
Well, I was just switching between the two antennas, but I got another radio. So now I have two, and I was wondering that question.
So if you got the two radios connected to the two antennas, and you transmit out of one, I think it's very unlikely you're going to damage the other. Less than a 1% chance, I think, that close of spacing is going to give you enough signal. How much power do the two radios run, Ben? Go ahead.
Run maximum 50 watts.
It is pushing it a little bit. 50 watts out of one into the other. If the other one had a delicate front end, could that do it with 3 foot of spacing? By the way, are the two antennas at the exact same altitude with the 3 feet of spacing? If they were collinear, if one was higher than the other, you'd have a lot more isolation. If the two are both at the exact same altitude, in other words, the broadside signal out of one is hitting the broadside reception out of the other, that is the worst case condition. Are they at the exact same altitude? Are these two antennas along the ridge line of the roof of the house? Over to you, Ben.
Yeah, they're both in my attic and they're pretty much the same height. But actually, this is another question I had. I have a J-pole antenna, but it's too tall to fit in my attic. So if I put it on like an angle, would that make a difference in signal quality?
The answer is yes, but very slowly. The antenna you're listening to me on right now is a Yagi antenna, and it's rotated in polarization at a 45-degree angle. In other words, the dipole of the driven element is not perpendicular to the ground. It's not parallel to the ground. It's halfway between the two. I did that so that I'm halfway between the vertically polarized people on FM and the horizontal polarized people on sideband. I lose 3 dB by doing that. So if you rotate the antenna 45 degrees, if it was a perfectly clean environment with no reflection, you'd lose 3 dB of signal to the repeater. However, in your case where the antenna is inside of a house, let me drop it. Inside of an attic, and the attic has wiring, plumbing, all kinds of stuff. Even if your antenna was perfectly vertical, it doesn't mean you're radiating a vertically polarized signal, because the RF signal coming out of an antenna reflects off of every single object in the environment. All the metallic objects, of course, are giving you a major characteristic of reflection. Even the dielectric properties, even the rafters of the house are giving you a small amount of shift of the polarization, because once that radio signal is radiated into air, it wants to see nothing but 377 ohms of impedance of air. The wood of the rafters of your house have got a dielectric constant of about 3 or 4. They've got a very different impedance compared to the air around them. And even them are giving you a slight amount of polarization shift of the signal that you finally radiate through that roof. So tilting the antenna, don't worry about it. Give it a try. And by the way, if you tilt it in a direction and you're not happy with the way the repeater responds, try tilting it in the other direction. Over to you, Ben, K2LIW.
Thanks for the information, and I'm going to try that out later.
Now, since these two antennas are in your attic, you have the ability of moving one of them to make the distance between the two a little more than 3 feet. 3 feet is roughly at my threshold of alarm, where one of the transmitters is at 50 watts. It'd be a hell of a lot safer at 4 feet than 3 feet, if you know what I mean. It's an inverse square law. Over to you, Ben.
Fine, move it. Actually, I have it a little bit short, but I can probably just make it longer and get some more. But, yeah, thanks for the information.
Good luck with those experiments. Come back with us in the future weeks and tell us how it all worked out, Ben. One last call. Is there anyone else that has any questions or comments for the net before we go over to the space report? Anybody else? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and TechNet.
Do I ask? Query.
Okay, after the beeps, go right ahead, Bill.
Space report, because there's something I heard recently that NASA's working on. I want to just understand more about it. W2YY.
Okay. We turned it over to Bill, and Joe just made a comment. Bill first. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
I'll try to keep this a quick question, even though there's much more of a backstory here, but I was recently working on an oscilloscope. It supposedly it's an analog scope that runs up to 50 megahertz, And so my question was, is an analog scope that's capable of and set to, you know, use signals running at 50 megahertz, does that beam sweep across the tube at 50 megahertz at, you know, approximately 50 million times a second? That seems unlikely to be within the capabilities of the scope to me. So that's my question. AC2IS.
Okay. If the signal was sweeping across the screen with a sawtooth waveform at 10 megahertz, and you viewed a 50 megahertz signal, and it made 10 million sweeps a second. In other words, the sweep takes 100 nanoseconds. The sweep takes 100 nanoseconds to go across the screen. And you're looking at a 50 megacycle signal. You'll simply see 5 sine waves across that screen. So is it really moving that fast? I think the answer is yes, Bill. You have no choice. AC2IS, K2IW.
It's, I guess, a little bit hard for me to believe. Like, if there's any variation in that signal, you're going to see basically a blur since the traces don't line up exactly. But if it's a very stable signal, and okay, I guess, you know, the phosphors would be lit the same way every, you know, if it's sweeping the screen at 10 megahertz, you know, 10 million times a second. Okay, I just assumed that the oscilloscope would have some ability to store a minute amount of signal, and that you were seeing some fraction of the signal at some duty cycle, but I guess that's not the case. And CRT tubes in analog scopes are actually able to sweep that quickly. Thanks for the info. AC2IS.
A sampling oscilloscope can do some kind of storage like you're talking about there, Bill. One of the things you'll notice is that when you have the sweep rate set at a slow rate and you set normal brilliance on the screen, and then you go to the highest sweep rate, you notice that the beam is hitting the phosphor for a very brief period of time, and therefore you don't get as much brilliance. So that when you're on the faster sweep rate, you're going to have to turn the brightness brighter on the screen. The fastest you can directly display on a phosphor screen is around 450 megacycles. High-class oscilloscopes, before you get into the sampling function scopes, can display 450 megacycles on the screen. So your beam is dwelling on the phosphor particles for such a brief period of time, you don't get full brilliance out of them. I think Andy wants to give us some information about how fast you can see an oscilloscope. CDL, to take it, KQIW. Go ahead, Andy.
Quick break into HVR.
Do you have an emergency?
No, just a break.
And you're not supposed to use that word. HVR, you're on the list. You're going to be after RYY. Andy, W-H-U-C-D-L, K-Q-I-W, go ahead, Andy.
I'm on the phone, Dick. I didn't check in, but I'm listening. Are you calling me for a reason?
I heard you check in. As if you were talking, over the air, we heard your voice, we heard your call letters. Maybe you keyed the mic by mistake. Over to you, Andy.
Excuse me, Dick. He was connected to my system on UHF, was connected to IRLP, to your repeater system. I disconnected that. He checked in on UHF, and you probably heard him inadvertently come out on high band.
Okay, now we know how Andy...
Repeater, time out.
Now we know how Andy's voice appeared by mistake. Okay, yeah. I have something to add, Dick. Go ahead, Eric.
One thing about source code. By the way, Tektronix made it direct to read, I think it's a gigahertz. That 5 cycles that you're looking at being played over and over again, actually, it's the first 5 cycles played over the next 5 cycles, and that builds up persistence in the phosphor to get to see it. If you look at a single shot, if you set up a regular oscilloscope to do a single shot, you're barely going to see anything because there's not enough energy to light up that phosphor for that period of time, but there's this thing called persistence. In the digital scope today, basically, you're writing and reading in real time into a hunk of memory, and you can stop it at any point in time and save that image, as opposed to the old days, where you actually put a BIOS on the phosphor, you kept the phosphor lit up.
Yeah, Bill was also worried about the fact that the individual sweeps are not going to line up with each other. That's strictly a function of how good is the triggering circuit of your oscilloscope. If you've got a nice, stable triggering circuit properly set, every one of those sweeps will begin at the exact same phase angle of that sine wave that you're displaying, and they will all lay right on top of each other. So with a good triggering circuit, as long as you don't have any residual SM in your signal you're displaying, they all will lay right on top of each other. AC2IS, K2IW, Grandville.
Hey, Dick. I'm away from the radio right now, so I'm not sure if you can hear me on the HT. But yeah, we saw some interesting signals today that seemed like there was a, you know, not a sine wave, but an irregular pattern, and yet that irregular pattern seemed to hold. So it's kind of surprising to me that can work, but it seems to work. AC2IS.
As long as the event you're looking at is a repetitive event, you've got a good triggering circuit. Every sweep will lay on top of each other. Joe wanted to give us some comments on all of the above. W2LYY, C2RAW, great, Joe.
I got an interesting tidbit for you, Dick.
I heard somebody say, N2VHQ listening. You were transmitting on the output frequency of the repeater, not the input frequency. I heard you. I don't think anyone else heard you. So you're going to have to change the way your rig is set. Go ahead, Eric. K2EJ, K2IW.
This is a specific thing that I've been having to deal with. Did you know that FM broadcast stations actually transmit their ID in CW, Morse code?
Okay. By what method of modulation of the Morse code for the ID does the person listening to QXR music, so to speak, he doesn't hear that Morse code. So what's the method of transmission, Eric? Go ahead.
The FCC allows two different methods of transmission. One is FSK between 5 kilohertz and 25 kilohertz. And the other method is 30% amplitude modulation.
So because of the operation of the limiter discriminator of the FM receiver, you never hear the amplitude modulation. Huh. And the frequency shift keying, 5 kilohertz to 25 kilohertz. Wouldn't a good listener with a good set of ears hear the 5 kilohertz signal going on and off? Over to you, Eric.
Not really. The amount of shift is, most people are using something like 7.5 kilohertz for the shift frequency. Don't forget, it's just a shift to the different frequencies. Yeah, the modulation of depth of it is very small. So, I mean, it's possible, but I don't think so. But then again, I just discovered this because I've had to deal with it. I wasn't aware of it at all.
Yeah, you and I are led to believe that the announcer saying we pause for station identification, we thought that was the ID. It's all audio ID. When they're using Morse code ID, does that mean there's no longer a requirement for station identification, so to speak? Over to you, Eric.
No, there's a third way of identifying a station. Actually, there's a special class of station. This really applies to translators. Where the translator may have a call sign of W220 Alpha Bravo, where the 220 is the actual FM channel number. Most people won't know that the FM channels are actually numbered. You can either do one of three things. You can use method one, which is identifying it by voice. And by the way, it only has to be identified three times a day. That doesn't run every hour. Or by FSK or by amplitude modulates. No, and they specify that it's got to be a minimum of 500 hertz away from the AAS tones.
So you're telling me the FCC rules allows a broadcast station to identify itself only 3 times per day, and yet just about every single FM, television, AM channel is that identifying themselves at least once every half hour. Are they overdoing it, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, let me repeat what I said before, is that this applies to translators. Translators is where there's a primary station on one frequency. And because they want to cover an area that's, say, blocked by a mountain, and they have another transmitter that's on another frequency, picking up the main station, they can either identify that transmitter on the other side of the mountain via voice, and they have to do that 3 times a day, stating the call sign of the translator, not the primary station, or by CW. Either of those methods. So now the primary station doesn't have to give this wonky call sign on the air.
An ordinary television or FM broadcast station, what's the minimum period between an
hour?
Okay, you and I doubled. What did you say?
Once an hour.
You only have to identify once per hour. In almost every station identifies at least once every half hour. They're overdoing it, aren't they, Eric?
That is called marketing.
Okay. Some television broadcast stations will have a logo in the corner. Channel 13, for instance, has the word 13 in the lower right-hand corner. Is that considered an ID?
Oh, that is in no way a legal ID. Okay. That's marketing. A legal ID has to identify the station and its call sign. What some stations will do, you'll notice that they will put up the station call sign and the channel number on it if it's a long program and they don't want to interrupt it and it happens to be the hour. Most stations will do it on the half hour, but they're not required to. But that's considered a visual ID. But at some point when it breaks from a program like that, in the rules, there's got to be a voice announcement somewhere along with a visual ID.
So if you are doing a visual ID, you must back that up with an audio ID once per hour, Eric?
In the general case, yes. There's special cases where the answer to that can be no or delayed. But visually for a television station, but for a radio station, it's got to happen.
Back in the old analog television days, each individual broadcast channel had its own offset frequency. I think it was plus or minus or 0.5 kilohertz or something like that. There is no offset frequency on the digital TV these days. Is that true, Eric?
That's correct. The offset frequencies of 25 and 50 and 75 kilohertz to the analog station was really intended for identifying where your code channel source is from. It wasn't for a technical reason in terms of frequency. The fact that they're offset like that, instead of causing your picture to completely break up, so to speak, the fact that they're offset like that gave you these bars that people would see on the screen, so that in essence they knew that they were seeing a distant channel come in. But in the digital domain, really all that stuff is in the data. So, and they kind of figure that, let me let it drop.
By the way, in the old days, you used to be able to count the number of bars, therefore you could make an estimation as to how much offset, and therefore make a guess as to where the channel was coming from. Oh, you heard.
That's absolutely correct. Actually, everybody would have one of these TV back books, which would identify the station, what the offset was, what the frequency, and by the way, the offset could be plus, or the offset could be minus. But in the digital world, they kind of figure that if you're getting code channel, you ain't watching anything, so they're not worried about it.
Yep. I suspect that modern digital television, if the co-channel interference is less than 15 dB weaker, there's a good chance your converter is going to say the bit error rate is too high and it's not going to give you a demodulation. Is that true, Eric?
Now let's put it this way. As co-channel starts to come in, you'll start to see the picture make some blocks. As the co-channel gets stronger, the blocks will get bigger and turn into lines and swatches of pictures that disappear, and the audio will start stuttering on you. When the co-channel gets even stronger, your picture will go to blank and you'll have no audio. And if it gets even stronger, you might even start to get the picture of the other station. So that's kind of how it works.
All of that degradation begins with the co-channel interference signal. Roughly how many dB weaker, Eric, go ahead.
Well, if it approaches, what is it? There's got to be at least a distance of 15, 20 dB between them for it not to have an effect. As it passes that point, then the symbol starts to get strong enough to be recognized.
So in the ideal world, the co-channel interference, that would be 15 or 20 decibels weaker. The COFDM that we're about to get, ATSC3, how many dB weaker can the co-channel in that case be, Eric? Is there a rough guess? K2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. My experience at this point, COFDM is really with EMG microwave and that kind of stuff. So it's a little bit of a different world because it's not as much bandwidth. And it's in a different form. So as to what the number is, I'm really at a loss to tell you, and I really should know, and I really should research it to find out. But it is, from what I understand, considerably better, but not perfect.
So the 15 or 20 dB requirement might become a 8 or 10 dB requirement. Is that a rough guess?
Yeah, I think that's probably where we're headed. It may be a little worse than that, but yeah, I think that's the zone we're looking at.
And in some cases, our current digital television is quite vulnerable to impulse noise. How's COFDM on impulse noise vulnerability, Eric? Any idea?
Now, considering you're transmitting 10 to 24 carriers, it really doesn't care if it loses 1 or 2 or 10 or 50 at any given point in time. And it'll survive that a lot better than ATSC will. That's for sure. The other thing that's built into the new standard is that if your TV set is, say, having to deal with those kind of issues, it might actually switch over to the handheld mode, which is less impervious to that, it's more impervious to that kind of junk. Whereas you can think of it as more spectrally within the band, so it has a better chance of surviving.
So you're saying a thoroughly adaptable television receiver has the ability to flip over to the handheld mode, a lower resolution mode, and once again, how many carriers are in there? Did you say a couple hundred over you, Eric?
How many what?
How many carriers?
It's in the power of 2, 1,024.
Now tell me about the handheld mode. In other words, the handheld device with lower resolution, there's a way it can demodulate the COFDM with worse conditions and still get a signal. Go ahead.
K2RWK2K. First of all, you've got the advantage of slower bit rate, that's one thing. There is a couple of stations in the office that transmit ATSC-M8, which is the handheld one. But they were never truly successful in getting the cell manufacturers to improve the receiver of that. Whereas with the ATSC-3, since some of the cell phone manufacturers and other developers the format, very likely to come in after they've shown quite a few of them put together already. It shows that it works quite well. So, yeah. Because of the floor bit rate, essentially it's individual carriers operating sort of in tandem with one another. I can't explain to you how it operates just yet. I mean, I have an idea, but I've got to get it more worked into my head before you start talking about it, because otherwise I'll be talking out of my head. But yeah, it'll survive that kind of stuff. It's why I never change it again.
The new television system we're going to be seeing in the next few years is called COFDM. OFDM is Orthogonal Frequency Division Multiplex, I presume. Does the C stand for coded or coherent? What does the C stand for of COFDM? Over you, Eric.
The transmission standard is really OFDM. Okay, it's orthogonal modulation. The C stands for coded, and it's coded in a specific way. And in that coding, there's several different forms of error correction.
So it has the Derby forward error correcting built in, Eric? 5% of the bits are forward error correcting bits?
True, just like, you don't realize it, but APSD is the same way.
So even with that forward error correcting, still needs 15 to 20 dB of carrier to carrier ratio and co-channel interference. Amazing. Okay, there was another person who wanted to make a question or a comment. Who was that person? Give me a call. There's a name right now. It's your RIW the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Evening, Dick. It's Nick N2HVR with a question. Sorry about the break.
And two, Hotel Victor Radio. Go right ahead, Nick.
Did anybody mention, usually I listen to you every week, but I listen to you on Echolink on my phone. I tested my phone, I also tested my iPod with an Echolink server. So there's no audio coming out of the Echolink, although I connected to it, and I saw other stations. But for some reason there's no audio output. Are you aware of that?
Normally the Echolink is operational when 375 is operational. Right now 375 is operational, so got a guess as to what's happening here, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
I just hope my computer's gonna take a minute or so to boot and I'll fix whatever it is.
Sounds like the audio is on the way, Nick, as soon as Erica reboots his computer. N2HVR for any other comments. Wait for the beep. K2RIW, be glad, Nick.
All right, K2RIW, this is N2HVR. Thanks. So, I just wanted to make you aware of it. I listen every week, but usually just on the Echo Link, unless I want to ask a question, now I'm on the radio. All right, so I'll be listening to that. Hopefully that'll work out. Back to you, K2RIW, this is N2HVR.
Nick, do you believe the audio dropped out sometime in the last hour or so, or do you believe the audio on Echolink was absent throughout all of the transmission tonight and maybe earlier today? When do you believe the Echolink audio disappeared? Back to you, Nick.
Well, I turned on Echolink on my Android phone at around 8 o'clock, and there was no audio. There were other stations that I could see that were on. And I thought maybe it was my phone, so I charged my iPod, and then I checked the Echolink server, and the Echolink server came through, so there's nothing wrong with my phone.
Okay, so we don't know when the Echolink dropped out.
normal circumstances, Eric, is the Echo Link audio there 24 hours a day, or is it only there on specific occasions like the TechNet? KE2EJ, if you're available, KE2RIW and the TechNet.
KE2RIW, KE2J. Echo Link's working now. It's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, there's only one station connected to somebody that just dropped out, I think it was W2RE. But we've got KC2MDCC connected. Yeah, it says keep the software thing running under Windows XP. XP starts complaining about it's expired, you know, that the XP is no longer being supported, and that kind of gums the world up. It happens randomly, maybe. So, I'll have to see about finding out how to kill that then. KE2RIW, KE2J.
Do you have to do that Echo Link restoration once every week or so, Eric? Is that what's going on?
This is the second time I've seen it happen. The first time I saw it happen was, I think, 3 weeks ago.
According to the latest issue of the Limock log, you're going to be killing the repeater at midnight every night and not turning it back on until like 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. Is that true, Greg?
No, you're usually asleep by then, but yeah, that's been happening for this last month.
Yeah, it was announced, to my knowledge, the first time in the latest issue of the Limock log a couple of days ago. So, the machine is turned off at midnight every day, and roughly what hour in the morning is turned back on, Eric?
At 5 a.m. It was requested, and it does actually eliminate the computers and a lot of other things, so. That's what they wanted, that's what they got.
If a particular communication between two guys on Limock occurred, let me pick a number, 2 days ago, is there a place if I was full equipped? Is there a place I could go to and play back the recording of 2 days ago? KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
No, I'm not sure I should answer that on the air, but let's put it this way. If there was something important you could request from the club, if they could help you out.
I understand. So the normal streaming process is quasi-live. In other words, if I listen to that stream, I'm listening to something with about 5 seconds of delay. But other than that, to the normal listener, that's all that's available to me. Is that true?
Being as popular a repeater as it is, it's actually available in multiple places. But yeah, for all practical purposes, you can consider it live. It's just, you know, it's a matter of codecing and, you know, motoring it from either end and getting it from one place to the other and then getting it to wherever you're listening to. It takes a little time.
You said there are multiple places. Could you list a couple of them for me?
I think you can get it from the Limock website. I think that may send you over to W2LIE, which is a scanner site which to us and which to other cities, which is the police department, and whatever they're transmitting, it's unencrypted, fire, and so on and so forth.
So, by way of W2LIE, that's the second. You said there's many places I could get it. W2LIE, really the only one?
No. I can't remember the address of the other one. But there's another one. I think there's two more. Not sure.
Okay, I thank you. One last call. Is anyone else with a question or a comment they want to make before we go over to the space report, give me a call letters right now. KQRIW. Well, sounds like it's time for space report number 258. What has NASA and ESA and all those other space people and Elon Musk and SpaceX, what have all those guys been doing this week? And what are they going to be doing in the next week? WS2N, KQRIW. You got a pull.
This is WS2N. Elon Musk is very busy with SpaceX. In the last 7 months, they've launched 10 Falcon 9 rockets into orbit successfully and brought back quite a few boosters. The last one that went up was on Wednesday from Launch Complex 39A in Florida, and that was a geosynchronous flight for Intelsat 35E, and that finally got off successfully. It was delayed two days in a row. They tried to launch, and they got down to 9 seconds, and it was scrubbed due to the GNC guidance navigation control computer on board the rocket. And apparently another problem, but not the same problem. They got down to 10 seconds the next time, and then they finally got it off. The day after the 4th of July, I'll be dropping. That wasn't one of the ones that they planned on recovering. That was an evolved, expendable booster launch vehicle. They did not install the titanium fins that normally is installed to fly it back to either Cape Canaveral or to the autonomous drone ship. And of course, it didn't have landing legs. That adds to a lot of weight. They needed all the fuel they could get to get this on the heavy side. They said it was the heaviest satellite geosynchronous orbit for SpaceX to date. So, now, you know, within 9 days, they had 3 launches. Two of those launches were about, I think, 48 hours apart, one from the West Coast, one from the East Coast. West Coast was another 10 Iridium satellites, 2,000 pounds each, that went into orbit. Second time SpaceX has done that, so now they have 20 Iridium satellites in the orbit, and they have to do this, I think, at least 4 more times. So over the next year or so, they plan on at least 4 more launches like that. And they got a Bulgaria satellite off on 39A. And they have like 10 more flights planned for the rest of the year. So they're building quite a few rockets. Even though they're reusing some boosters, they have increased their flights. The manifest is overwhelming, according to Elon Musk. They got a lot of flights plan that have to get off the ground. And so some people are canceling and going with other people. But it takes so long to get a flight off the ground. So the big news for SpaceX, they had a Dragon attached to the International Space Station for the last month. They call that CRS number 11 cargo or resupply. So that was attached for a month, and then now deorbited with science equipment and everything on board that needs to be returned to Earth. And Dragon comes back on a parachute and lands in the Pacific Ocean near Baja, California, a couple hundred miles off the coast. And this particular CRS-11 was launched, I think it was 2014. It was the fourth mission, CRS number 4. So that spacecraft has been up to the space station and docked already. and not sort of now allowing them to reuse not only the boosters for flight, but allowing them to reuse the Dragon spacecraft itself. Their ultimate goal is to reuse everything. That's Elon Musk's ultimate goal. Still a ways off from doing that, but he's getting close. Guiding in the fairings. That encapsulate the top of the rocket, you know, that has the payloads inside, able to fly them and down on parachutes. He's able to find them floating around in the water. When they come back, the Dragon, of course, doesn't need the fairings, but when he sends the satellite up, he has either 4 or 5 meter diameter fairings that are very expensive. He claims they're $6 million a piece, so he'd rather reclaim them and reuse them if he can. So he's trying to drive down the course of launching vehicles. Let me drop it. China is not doing as well. They had a failure about a month or two ago with one of their long march rockets. They have different numbers, you know, 2, 3, 5, 7. And 5 is their heavy lift vehicle. And that just went up last week as well. And apparently it did not get its payload, whatever it was, to orbit. They had live TV. They said they followed the launch and went up. Second stage was ignited, and apparently there was a problem at that point. And China pulled the on-air coverage of their rocket. And from what I've heard now, or read, they have not disclosed what the problem is. So we'll have to find out. So China's had some problems. I mean, they're really pushing. They're doing quite good. So the last couple of flights, they have had some problems they got to work out. So they said they noticed a plume of gas, you know, coming out, you know, of the rocket. And the first stage, that might indicate a problem. We'll have to see. Another topic that you emailed me, a story about Restore L. Planned flight that NASA will be eventually sending up. The idea is to save a satellite that's been in trouble for quite some time. The satellite's up a little over 400 miles. It's not geosynchronous, but it's Landsat 7. And it takes pictures, and that's the mission. There's other Landsat vehicles. And this one has problems. It's running out of fuel. And they plan on sending a robotic mission up to be able to open up a cap on Landsat 7, refuel it, put some rocket fuel in there, and then, you know, when they leave that cap behind, it's got another fitting on it that will permanently attach to the satellite, which will be easier for them next time if they sent another repair vehicle or two, you know, or they wanted to refuel it. And now some of the companies, Boeing and Lockheed, they're developing satellites on Earth with this feature, so that it's going to be easier for future robotic satellites like Restore L to do that. I sent you an email, Dick. Let me drop it. So we did cover some a little bit about Restore L back in April. I found it on number 246. As you can see from that email, if you read it, that records of all these things down. I would bring up a task mission over the last 4 or 5 years. I'll be able to locate it. Back to you for any comments, and if you don't have any, nobody has any comments, there's more space topics, of course. Back to you. This is WS20.
Does anybody have any questions for Paul on the subject of space? Give me a call with us right now. K2RIW. Doesn't sound like anybody has any questions or comments, Paul, so go right ahead with some more space material. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the difference between these ion engines. We talked about before, ion engines, and there's another one called the Bessemer rocket engine. It's a variable specific impulse magnetoplasma rocket. They call it Bessemer. And this thing has the ability to be about, I think they said, 50 or so times more powerful than the regular ion engine. It's been under development for, you know, well over 10 years. But the guy that's doing this, he owns a company that's called Ad Astra. Ad Astra is now headquartered in Texas, not too far away from Johnson Space Center. He also has a facility down in Costa Rica, and his name is Chang Diaz. Chang Diaz is an astronaut and now not active. I mean, he's ready and willing to go up if NASA needs him again. He's flown on 7 different space shuttle missions. Let me drop it. The physicist that, you know, by trade, he wound up as an astronaut developing this engine, which is so different than the ion engines. Ion engines have been flown many times. Different countries are now flying them as well. China started, Russia. We have it with the, right now with the Dawn spacecraft that has 3 engines on board. They don't fire at the same time, one at a time, but they do have that. But they're different than the Bessemer engine. Bessemer is a lot more powerful. Wants to use it for eventually deep space travel to Mars, for instance. You mount one of these things on there and theoretically make it in 2 months instead of, say, 6 or 8 months with this Bessemer engine. And I found, you know, one of his articles on how it works. Regular ion engines like that we have, NASA has on deep space missions like Dawn. Dawn is located in orbit around Ceres right now, originally around Vesta, and now, well, left Vesta, and now it's around Ceres. So the ability to actually leave orbit, go into orbit again. Now it has the ability maybe to leave that orbit. They haven't made a decision on what they're going to do with Dawn yet. And as this goes on, I mean, I think it was launched back in 2007, so it's now over a little over 10 years. You have an active spacecraft still with fuel on board. The fuel is Xeon fuel, in the case of ion engines. They managed to ionize the gas and then eventually push it out the exhaust. And they're really called a Hall thruster system, what really Dawn spacecraft is. But the Bessemer is different, where with what Chang Diaz is doing with Ad Astra. That company is taking a fuel. They're not using Xeon. They're using argon for some reason. Looking at the periodic table, Xeon looks heavier, but there must be some reason he's using argon, which is still a relatively heavy fuel. But he's ionizing it. It's got like a 3-step process. He's using RF to ionize the gas, and he gets it up like 50,000 degrees. And then it goes to the second chamber. And again, he heats it up even more with more RF to 3.5 million degrees. And then he guides it out of the back using magnets. Now, each stage has magnetic.